Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare, where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. That's imagine.dh.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Pundits are calling it an election like no other in terms of how long it's lasted, the powerful role of debates, and the unprecedented amounts of money being spent. Today, Canadians go to the polls to choose a new federal government, and many say change could be in the air after a decade of the Conservative Party in power. A lot is at stake, including Canada's participation in international efforts to fight terrorism, whether the country votes to support the Trans-Pacific trade deal, and how Canada's resource-rich economy deals with a slump in world energy prices. Immigration has also been a huge topic of discussion, displaying deep social divides about what it really means to be Canadian. Today in The Exchange, we go north of New Hampshire's notches to Canada to see what these elections are about and how they might affect the broader U.S.-Canada relationship. Let's hear from you, too. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. Joining us from Ottawa is Margot McDermid, national reporter in the Parliamentary Bureau for Canada's National Public Broadcaster, the CBC. Margot, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Also with us, Kirk Dorsey, professor of history at UNH. He teaches courses on U.S. foreign policy and environmental history. And Kirk, welcome back. It's great to see you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us, Zach Azem. He's a research associate at the UNH Survey Center. His master's thesis was on Canada's 2011 federal election. And Zach, it's good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, all of you, all the writing and reading that I've been doing to prepare for this show says one thing, and I'll turn to you first, Margot, that these elections are a big deal, that a lot is at stake. But Margot, you know, elections are always a big deal. Are these more significant? Do they feel more significant to you?
Definitely. This election is like no other I've ever seen in Canada. First of all, the length, 78 days now, not long for Americans, but really long for Canadians. Normally, our elections are about 37 days, so twice the length of time. Lots of money, five debates. And really, what this election is about is it's the direction of the country. And it could determine a change in the direction of the country, because for the past nearly 10 years, we've had a Conservative government that has pushed us to the right fiscally, but also right to the right in terms of international affairs, environment, social programs, just about everything. So it became very quickly clear in August when the election was called that it was about change. So it was going to be really an election about whether do people want Stephen Harper to continue as prime minister. And he's not popular. He has really made a lot of enemies in the last 10 years for his bellicose sort of autocratic style, sort of my way or the highway, throw people under the bus kind of style. Or is it going to be about choosing from the other two parties, the other guys? So is it the Conservatives or the other guys? And that's really what it has boiled down to as the polls open. Actually, they just opened now in Eastern Ontario. Do you want this or do you want change? And so now, you know, the theme in this campaign, really, when it got started, was people would say, oh, you know, I don't care who gets elected as long as it's not the Conservatives. And that has actually been the theme throughout the entire 11 weeks. And so it's come right down to Stephen Harper facing two others. It started out with the NDP, which is a left-leaning party, leading in the polls. They're now third in the polls, and we now have this young, novice politician, Justin Trudeau, the son of Pierre Trudeau, leading in the polls, with the Conservatives set to possibly lose. So it's going to be a squeaker, because in Canada, it's the plurality of votes that win you the election. So every vote counts. You know, some places are won by 100 votes. So
wow,
a really interesting race here.
Well, and you've hinted at a couple ways that your system is different from ours, the parliamentary system. And I do want to get to that, Margot. But to call on our guests in studio first, what do you think, Kirk? Everybody's saying there's so much at stake in these elections.
There are. It's quite a change. After 9 years of conservative leadership, it's almost certainly going to fall today, although it's unsure. And I think particularly from the standpoint of the United States, there are a lot of things at issue. I mean, if you really look at American-Canadian relations, say, since World War II, there's been sort of a partnership where the U.S. has been the muscle and Canada has been the conscience. So that's certainly how Canadians like to think about it.
The muscle and the conscience.
I think so. I mean, the Canadians have
built
a peacekeeper memorial in Ottawa. And, I think there's been an alliance in things like NATO and NAFTA, and these aren't going to break apart over this election. But it is really interesting over the last several years that Stephen Harper has been much more aggressive in his foreign policy than Barack Obama in many ways. I mean, he's been identified as a steadfast friend of Israel, which Barack Obama has been questioning. He's been taking air campaign into Syria against ISIS, which the United States has been sort of hesitant to do but has done. So in some ways, there's been a little bit of a reversal in the last 6 or 7 years, where Canada, in many ways, has been much more robust in its foreign policy. So that's definitely, I think that's going to change. I'm sure that Barack Obama is watching the election returns and looking forward to a Trudeau prime ministership.
And I'm glad you mentioned the U.S. perspective. And just real quick, Kirk, I've got a headline here from the Guardian newspaper. It says, "Why Americans Should Care About the Canadian Election." Why do you think Americans should care?
Well, I think that, for one thing, there's so many similarities between the two societies, and we can see trends that happen in both societies that are common. I mean, we have such commonalities in terms of social media and in terms of the ways we look at our candidates and through the lens of authenticity as much as by what they stand for, who they are. But I think the relationship is the biggest trading partnership in the world. Things that matter in the United States in the upcoming election, like the Keystone Pipeline and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, are real live issues in Canada as well right now. So I think that there could be direct impacts. It's not going to be earth-shaking. We're not going to wake up tomorrow with a vastly different relationship with Canada. But there will be implications for the American economy based on who is in charge in Ottawa.
Yeah, Zach, I'd love your perspective on these elections, either from the Canadian perspective or the U.S. perspective.
Sure. Well, just to follow up what Kirk was saying. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, we've certainly heard a lot about it in this country. And depending on which party ends up winning this election, it could have a very big impact on that. Stephen Harper has kind of gone out of his way to endorse that deal. The Liberals are kind of taking a wait-and-see approach, and the NDP is staunchly against it. So from that perspective, who wins that election matters, as well as the Conservatives passed a bill that I don't want to compare too much, but it's similar to the Patriot Act. It's called Bill C-51. And so it strengthens the ability of agencies to share information. It allows people to be monitored more closely. And, the Liberals are looking at keeping some parts but maybe getting rid of some other parts. And the NDP views it as, just totally against civil liberties. And they're looking to repeal it, immediately.
So that's got implications for intelligence sharing between the two countries. And
absolutely,
there's that big border. And I'm guessing that American intelligence folks are looking at that bill and the outcome of these elections.
Right. So certainly those are two big issues that could definitely have an impact as far as we're concerned.
Again, the Exchange phone number for you to join us with your questions and comments about Canadian elections today. And as we're hearing, these are a big deal. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. So, Margot, just to clarify, and everybody's hinted at this, but you said when the election was called. So under a parliamentary system, that's how it works, Margot. It isn't that, the first Tuesday of November is automatically election day, or the second Tuesday, or whatever. it's called?
Well, we do have a fixed election day, which is the third Monday in October. It turns out it was the 19th this time around, every 4 years. So the third Monday in October every 4 years, although the Prime Minister Harper has broken his own election act a couple of times and called the election early. So for what it's worth. So but he can actually say, as Prime Minister, we can have an election as long as we can have a 15-week election, a 3-month election. So what he chose to do was to call it on the say, OK, we're going to start campaigning now and we will have the vote October 19th. But he could have said, let's start campaigning the beginning of September, but he didn't. He did it the beginning of August for a bunch of reasons, including the fact that the Conservatives have wads of money. So they thought they'd outspend their opponents, the NDP and the Liberals. And they wanted to really sort of outspend their opponents, who are, you know, sort of lobby groups, too, that were saying, get rid of this guy, get rid of Harper. So they felt they would have the advantage by having a longer campaign. What it's turned out, though, is it's actually energized Justin Trudeau, who's a young guy who's got lots of energy, and it seems that everywhere he goes, the more he campaigns, the more supporters he gets. So that's one of the things that has happened in this campaign that has turned it on its ear and been a surprise. So he called it in August for the vote in October, and that's basically the way it works in Canada.
Okay, and just to clarify, Margot, so Stephen Harper, he's with the Conservative Party. He's been in power basically from basically a decade.
2006.
And then you've got Mr. Mulcair from the NDP. What does NDP stand for? And it sounds like from what you all are saying, that's the most liberal party.
It's the most left-wing party. It's the New Democratic Party.
Okay.
And they have socialist roots, although they have done their best to sort of play that down in this campaign, which in fact has been one of his problems. So that's Tom Mulcair, who is from Quebec. He's fully bilingual, and he took over the party when the former leader, Jack Layton, died of cancer after he swept Quebec in the last election in 2011. So he's inherited essentially the party from Jack Layton. It's his first campaign. Justin Trudeau is the leader of the Liberals that were almost decimated in the 2000 election campaign under Michael Ignatieff. And he took over a party that was essentially in the gutter and has rebuilt it to be a very different party, much more optimistic. He got rid of all the old guard and sort of moved forward with a sort of a new approach to politics, a lot of social media, a lot of sort of connection with supporters in a different way. And as I mentioned before, he's the son of Pierre Trudeau, who's Canada's former prime minister, ruled for 15 years from the mid-60s right through to the 80s.
15 years, wow.
Yeah, well, he was defeated for a short time in the middle there in the 70s, but he came back and he really put Canada on the map in many ways, and was one of the reasons why a lot of people came to Canada. A lot of the people who come out to see Justin Trudeau say, I remember your father. He's the reason I came to Canada. They even bring old Christmas cards they got from the Prime Minister, Pierre Trudeau, for Justin to sign. So there's this really interesting political legacy connected with Trudeau, who is a bit of a star. He's a bit of a celebrity, but very untested and very new at politics.
Well, and let's hear a little bit from Justin Trudeau on the campaign trail. Here he is at a rally describing what he called Conservative leader Stephen Harper's divisive politics. Let's hear.
For 10 years, Stephen Harper has never missed an opportunity to divide Canadians, East against West, urban against rural, French against English, so-called old stock Canadians versus newcomers. His first instinct is to appeal to the worst instincts. He and his party have brought unprecedented nastiness to our country's public life. Their way of doing politics is mean and small and negative, but it doesn't have to be that way, my friends.
Again, that's Liberal leader Justin Trudeau at a rally in Canada. The Canadian elections are today, as we're hearing, and a lot is at stake. You can join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And all of you, part of the reason we played that is we just wanted to hear Justin Trudeau. As Margot said, he's really captivated people. But the other reason, and I'll turn to you first, I think, Kirk, is that he raises the immigration issue. He says Stephen Harper is dividing Canadians, East against West, French against English, old stock Canadians versus newcomers. And you heard people go, boo, there. What's going on with the immigration issue in Canada? We think of it as a very open immigration society.
Yes, and it has been. I mean, but there's also been a tradition of being very selective about who gets let into the country. Back, for instance, when Hong Kong was switching back to China, they were very welcoming. Canada was very welcoming of people from Hong Kong who had a certain amount of resources. So there's been a history of some selectivity in Canadian foreign policy. That's not in immigration policy, which is not surprising. But the particular issue right now is that Stephen Harper has hit on the Muslim headscarf issue, the niqab, which is and basically saying that when you are sworn in as a citizen, when you come to Canada, you've taken the oath of citizenship, your face has to be uncovered. And it's a relatively small point in terms of how many people it affects, but it's a huge point in terms – as Harper's making it, in terms of what we stand for as Canadians. And Zach and I were talking before the program, and he basically led Thomas Mulcair right into a buzzsaw because Mulcair thought they should have the right to wear the niqab. But in Quebec, that's very unpopular, and the NDP looks like it's going to get really badly beaten in Quebec. But it may have ended up hurting Harper in the long run. But it is part of his effort to sort of emphasize what's unique about Canada. And it's playing right to his base. I mean, he may be divisive. Trudeau is correct in some ways, but he wins. So he's going to keep doing what he has to do to win. That's his whole point. He's never had 50% of the vote, but he's had a majority.
Well, and since you mentioned the niqab controversy, I definitely want to hear from you, Margot and Zach. But we've got Stephen Harper talking about this. Here's Prime Minister Stephen Harper speaking to the House of Commons on why he feels this particular head covering, the Muslim niqab, is un-Canadian, in his words.
We don't allow people to go uncovered, to cover their faces during citizenship ceremonies. And why would Canadians, contrary to our own values, embrace a practice at that time that is not transparent, that is not open, and frankly is rooted in a culture that is anti-women? And, Mr. Speaker, that is unacceptable to Canadians, unacceptable to Canadian women, and that's why this government...
Again, Stephen Harper speaking to a rowdy House of Commons. Margot, we're always a little envious of all that liveliness. Our Congress doesn't tend to do that. But can you just give us your take on this whole sort of Muslim immigration head covering and how it's been playing out in these Canadian elections? And Zach, I want to hear from you, too. But go ahead, Margot.
Well, I think the niqab was actually a pivotal issue in this election and actually has led to a slump of the NDP in the polls. And the reason I say that is because of the way it's played out. The niqab is not only a headscarf, but it's also the covering the face from, you know, the eyes down. And there are very few women in Canada who wear it, but there are some. And so really what this is about is the Conservative government brought in a policy, not a law, but a policy that when you take the citizenship oath, you must uncover your face. But before that, the women who are about to become citizens have already identified themselves with a female immigration officer. So it's not like somebody who is pretending to be somebody else. They've already been properly identified. So this is just a public ceremony. So women, Muslim women, say, I have a right, you know, to be a devout Muslim, and this is, and part of it is covering my face for some women. And so the one woman actually fought that in the federal court and won the right to cover her face. And that's after that happened in the middle of this election, that's when it blew up. So the Conservatives came out saying it's anti-woman. When you talk to Muslim women, they say it's actually not. It's our choice. The NDP said, we don't like it, but we have to follow the law. And the law says women should be able to cover their faces. And that's where they lost support in Quebec. 93% of people in Quebec believe that women should uncover their faces. So that's when the NDP started to say that, they started to slide in the polls. And this anybody but conservative movement in Canada went, uh-oh, the NDP aren't going to win after all. Let's all jump on the Liberals or let's turn our faces. That's what happened. That was
okay.
That pivotal moment.
Because
so,
you got this
right
three-way thing that we don't have here. We have, you know, Republican, Democrat. Go ahead, Zach. I'd love to hear from you, too.
Well, and also in Quebec, it's actually a four-way race. So there's still the Bloc Québécois Separatist Party that's still around. But just to get back to sort of the buzzsaw, as Kirk said, that Thomas Mulcair stepped in, you know, the NDP – they became the official opposition for the first time in 2011, and it was sort of on the back of all the seats they won in Quebec. But now that they have that support, Mulcair is kind of in this balancing act where he needs to appease both French Canada and English Canada. And by not, you know, coming out on this issue,
It's troublesome for him.
And so he's got to, you know, he's losing support there. The liberals are coalescing, and there's an opposition party in the liberals that the conservatives now have to worry about.
Speaking of buzzsaws, we'll talk about the French-Canadian issue in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a look at the elections in Canada happening right now. We're looking at some of the issues that concern voters in our big neighbor to the north. We'd love to hear from you, your questions about how Canadian elections and the parliamentary system work, or comments on some of the issues that have come up in this voting. 1-800-892-6477 is our number here on The Exchange. 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. Find us on Twitter. Our guests for the hour are Margot McDermid. She's a national reporter in the Parliamentary Bureau for the CBC. Kirk Dorsey, professor of history at UNH. He teaches courses on U.S. foreign policy and environmental history. And Zaka Zem, research associate at the UNH Survey Center. His master's thesis was on Canada's 2011 federal election. And all of you, I want to start with you first, Zach. Everybody keeps mentioning Quebec, and obviously it's a big province, but how does Quebec figure so large in these national elections? There are lots of other provinces. Canada's a big country.
Sure. Well, typically, the party that wins Quebec is in very good shape to govern parliament. And so actually, there's been a single party has won a majority of Quebec seats all the way going back since 1962. Now that changes. It's been the Conservatives in the 80s, then the Liberals, then the Bloc Québécois. Now it's been the NDP. But we're in a position right now where the NDP, the Liberals, the Bloc, and the Conservatives are all kind of running neck and neck. So it's difficult to see a party that's going to kind of run away with Quebec this time around.
But Quebec is really important. Basically, as goes Quebec, so goes the nation. I mean,
sure. And also Quebec, Ontario, and British Columbia, just three provinces, they make up over 70% of the seats.
Really?
And all three of them, we're seeing these tight races. So in Ontario, it's the Liberals and Conservatives. In British Columbia, it's the NDP, Liberals and Conservatives. And as I said, in Quebec, it's four ways. So that's why the outcome is so unsure, because it's going to come down to a lot of tight races.
Wow. Kirk, how come we're not hearing as much about the French issue this time around? In years past, when you and I have talked about Canadian elections, that's been the first thing that's come up, this split between English and French-speaking Canada. Now, when you look at the elections, you hear about immigration, Keystone, terrorism, very different.
Well, I think the separatist movement really burned out. It flared in the 80s and the 90s, came very close to winning an election, a referendum, based on whether or not Quebec should stay within Canada, which would have been a really interesting we'd still be dealing with the ramifications of that as Quebec tried to separate out from the rest of Canada, whether or not Canada allowed it, whether or not we'd recognize Quebec as an independent state. But when that referendum in the mid-90s lost, that really burned out a lot of the support. You can only get that much that fired up about leaving your country for so long. And I think at a certain point, the issues that allowed a lot of Quebecois to say we want out, they lost. They were going to move on. And, you know, if you look at the governing parties, the Parti Québécois within the province and the Bloc Québécois, the national party that goes to the national parliament, they've had some real problems. I think part of the issue is that the parties leading the issue of separatism also, they had a core of leaders, some of whom got ill and died, some of whom got caught up in corruption scandals and other things. And so the real people who are firing up the separatist movement have lost a lot of their power. The issue has died down in part because I think the people who supported it realized they had lost, but also because the rest of Canada made steps to sort of assuage Quebec and say, we accept that you have separation issues and we're going to work with those. So I think by and large, the separatist people who supported separatism, they would still probably take it if it came, but it's no longer the central issue. And at the same time, if we're talking about immigration, people who are moving into Quebec are moving into Quebec not to get out of Canada, but they're seeing Montreal as part of Canada, as part of North America. They want to be there. I mean, this is, as you were talking about the immigration issue, you know, Toronto and Montreal are real immigrant cities. It's amazing all the different languages and foods and things you can get in either of those cities. And those immigrants are not attached to that deep history that, you know, it's on the license plate, je me souviens, you know, I remember. They don't remember that, you know, 1763 was a completely different world. So that separatist fire just doesn't even appeal to them or apply to them. They can't understand that.
Any separatist sparks or embers, Margot, this time around, or is it completely off the table?
I don't think you can ever say that it's off the table in Canada. I think it simmers somewhere down below the surface, you know, either lower down or a little closer to the surface, depending on what issues are occurring in Quebec. But you shouldn't, no one should ever assume that it's gone away completely. But the way it's played out in this election, and by the way, you were mentioning the Bloc Québécois, Gilles Duceppe, who's the leader, actually lost his seat in the 2011 election. He's come back to lead it again. And of course, the whole raison d'etre for the Bloc is to eventually, you know, separate from Canada. He's only expected to win maybe 2 seats, maybe 3, and may even lose his own or lose his bid to get his own back. So I think they're a force. They could be a spoiler for the other parties, but I don't think they're going to be a big force. But back to this whole idea of separatism. The reason why the immigration issue is so sensitive and why it flared up with the niqab is really based on this whole idea of masters in our own house that the Québécois say. And so they're very concerned when immigrants come into Canada. Many do come to Montreal because they're French speaking and it's a big city, that they adopt French as their first language and they adopt the Quebec culture, that they don't overnumber or outnumber the Québécois. So there's a real sensitivity of being a majority in their own province. And so that's why the immigration issue sort of spoke to people in Quebec. And that's why 93% did not want women to wear a niqab. They're very, very sensitive about that because it goes down to their culture and this whole idea of becoming a minority in their own home.
Again, our phone number here in the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, 1-800-892-6477. So, Margot, just to totally clarify, so do you think that French-speaking, longtime residents of Quebec will vote for Conservatives this time because they're nervous about immigration?
Some will. The expectation is that some around the Quebec City area, and the only explanation is they're different there. That's all the only explanation we ever get. And when you go there, it's true. They will. But overall, not in Montreal, not the largest city in Quebec. There is support for the NDP there, still good support. And there's growing support for the Liberals. So I don't think that I think the Conservatives are going to lose some seats in Quebec.
All right. One more clip I want to play for everybody on immigration. Then we should turn to the Keystone Pipeline and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because those are big issues that affect the U.S. But just to show you again how prominent this issue of immigration has been and refugees, whether the United States and Canada should take refugees from the Syrian crisis, for example, here's Prime Minister Harper in a televised debate criticizing the other candidates for being too open to immigration, openness that Mr. Harper fears could compromise national security.
These guys would have had, in the last 2 weeks, us throwing open our borders and literally hundreds of thousands of people coming without any kind of security check or documentation.
And that's
some
not
other
true, Mr.
Done.
Harper.
That would have been an enormous mistake.
See,
we're following a balanced
Mr. Harper
approach.
Plays
we're bringing more refugees.
Fears okay. where, all the
where
time.
We're providing
fears
more
of
humanity.
Others.
Okay, so again, that's a televised debate of the Canadian elections. Stephen Harper taking the lead there on immigration. Sounds like the U.S., Kirk, in a way. You know, we're concerned about national security, and yet, you know, people want to help out in the Syrian crisis.
Yes, well, because there was an attack in Ottawa just about a year ago where somebody shot a soldier right in front of the World War I Memorial.
That's right,
and
I remember that.
And went into the House of Parliament and had to be stopped by the Sergeant of Arms, a retired military man who basically shot him and killed him. And so it was a very dramatic moment. And in fact, Harper has said in a couple of things, a couple of times he said things like, well, they think there haven't been terrorist attacks in Canada. And he was clearly referencing that moment. So he's taking, just like in the United States post 9/11, you know, Zach mentioned the Patriot Act earlier, there was a spike in concern about who's getting into the country and how they're getting in and how we should be monitoring them. So he's taken that issue and built upon it. And I think we can also see in his willingness to participate in the campaign against ISIS that he is saying that this is a matter of national security for Canada, that this is an existential threat to Western democracy. So we're going to send Canadian forces in, even if it's a relatively small role similar to the way that Canadians participated in Afghanistan after 9/11, that there is something to be said for standing with other nations in the West on this particular issue.
Here's an email that came in from Susan, who says she's a Canadian-American. Thank you, Susan, for the email. She says, thank you so much for dedicating a show to something Canadian. She says, we Americans are woefully ignorant of the affairs of our neighbors to the North while they know so much about us. Susan, great to hear from you. What do you think? I'll turn to you first, Margot. Do you think that Canadians know a lot more about the U.S. than the U.S. knows about Canada?
Well, I'm going to quote Pierre Trudeau, Justin Trudeau's father, who said being Canadian is like sleeping with an elephant, and he was referring to the U.S. Yes, we do. We are a smaller population. We depend on the U.S. for our trade. We do know a lot more about the U.S. than the U.S. knows about us. And I think it is just because of numbers because of the type of role we play internationally. So it's something that Canadians are well aware of, and we kind of make jokes about it sometimes.
Well, Margot, what don't Americans get about Canada? I mean, if there's one thing that just drives you crazy, what is it? She says, one thing, really? That's all I can say? In terms of, you know, how your parliamentary system works or your elections or sort of your politics, your culture, what is it that we don't get about Canadian society?
I think two things. Well, I don't think people understand the parliamentary system, which is understandable. I mean, a lot of Canadians don't either, but it's based on the British system. So we can go into that later. I think Americans don't understand what is like to be a Canadian, to be so similar to an American, but different. And so I think that with that comes a little bit of a, not sort of a psychosis, but we're aware of it all the time when you travel outside of the country. You're always called an American. And Canadians actually take offense at that in some cases. So I think people in the U.S. just don't understand how important it is when you're a small culture, a small country, and a pretty big geographically, but really small, we're one-tenth of your population. What it's like to be, it's like being the younger brother all the time. And so, you know,
a nation of younger brothers.
That's right. I think that they don't get it. You do not get that.
Yeah. What about you, Zach? What don't Americans understand about Canada? You know, maybe when you started doing this research yourself a couple of years ago, what didn't you get about Canada?
Well, I'd just start off by first saying I'm frankly astounded hearing that we'd have a show on Canadian politics, because doing this research, I mean, really no one has any idea what's going on up there, which is a little bit, concerning that they're right above us. But I think that American politics are very interesting and, you know, sensational at times. And we kind of just stick with our own country's politics. I'm not sure it's a slight to Canada. We don't pay attention to a lot of other elections. But
don't take it personally. We ignore
everybody else.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's not a slight to Canada. We don't know a lot about other countries' elections as well. And actually, just watching a lot of Canadian news and stuff, I've always found it interesting that they, you know, talk about maybe something the Obama administration did that I didn't know about because the U.S. media is not reporting on it. I mean, I think that certainly the parliamentary system, the party structure, the distinction between Quebec and English Canada. I don't think that we have a very strong grasp in this country, but, you know, I hope that today's show will help give us a little insight on that.
Yeah. Kirk, what do you think?
Well, I think if you look at most Americans' attitudes towards Canada, it's just that Canada's sort of like a lot like the United States, except it's got this slightly different government. And if you look at it through the lens of humor, like the Onion for a long time used to talk about Canada and its capital, Canada City. You know, the joke that nobody even knew what Canada's capital was. And way back when the Simpsons referred to Canada as America Junior, you know, this idea.
There's that younger brother again.
And how hard it is to find way down there on the map, as Homer Simpson once said. So there's this general ignorance about things Canadian. And I think Canadians who are in the know recognize that for most Americans, there's far too much within the United States for us to keep track of, and we don't keep track of other countries' elections particularly well. We've got 50 states, and you know, we have trouble identifying all 50 of those. So I think most Canadians understand that their relationship is much more important for Canada than it is for the United States, because the United States has these kinds of military relationships with multiple and trade relationships with multiple countries. And that's part of the price of being a superpower. It's the same thing for Britain. And when it was at its peak, a lot of countries needed to know what Britain was up to more than the British subjects needed to know what the other countries in the world run to.
Well, and just to give a shout out for New Hampshire Public Radio, we do run As It Happens, which originates from the CBC, weeknights at 10 p.m. So a little bit of Canada on our airwaves. You can join us as well, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Thank you, Susan, for that email. You can email us as well, exchange at nhpr.org. So, Margot, since Kirk mentioned trade relationships and how important they are for Canada with the U.S., how heavily is this Trans-Pacific Partnership playing a role in your elections now? Is it a big deal, a small deal, or what?
Well, it became a big deal at the beginning of October when it became clear that the deal was actually going to be signed. And so the Conservatives were really anxious to get it signed as soon as possible because they have one of their platforms is that they're careful stewards of the economy, and they've been running on that heavily. So by signing this big trade deal made them look really good in their view. But what it also did was it gave some ammunition to the NDP in particular, because they're really, they say they're very concerned about aspects of the trade deal that would eat into the Canadian dairy industry and the Canadian auto industry. So nobody's really actually seen the details of the deal yet. So they can kind of project their fears on it and what they predict will happen. And it's actually helped them in the campaign. For the Liberals, they say, well, we're pro-trade and we're going to wait and see what is actually in the deal. But it's actually given the NDP some ammunition and helped them sort of pull out from underneath that NECAB shadow, which really affected their campaign. So the TPP was interesting because it just sort of landed sort of towards the last two-thirds of the campaign. And then when Hillary Clinton said she had some questions about it, Tom Mulcair just basically jumped up and down with glee because he said, see, you know, Hillary Clinton doesn't like it.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it played quite a role in our campaign.
Wow. Go ahead, Kirk. This is very interesting.
Well, it's very interesting. There's the history of trade between the United States and Canada is really central to understanding the relationship from the earliest days of Canadian existence. Certainly, if you go back to Confederation, one of the big issues was, would trade be east-west across the ocean or north-south with the United States? How was Canada going to focus? And so for most of its history, its modern history, Canada's been trying to find alternatives to trading with the United States just to diversify its economy. At the same time, recognizing that prosperity depended on selling raw materials like oil in Alberta to the American market because it's the largest market in the world. And so there's this tension between not wanting to be the little brothers, as Margot so well put it, and always having to follow the American economy. One of the problems is, if the United States gets a cold, or the United States sniffles, Canada gets a cold. So
right.
This is, I think, it might have been Trudeau who said that as well. So you don't want to be tied to the United States, but at the same time, you don't want to be shut off from the United States.
Well, so could this Trans-Pacific Partnership, has someone made the argument, Kirk, that this Trans-Pacific Partnership might help Canada not depend on the U.S. so much because you could open up trade with East and West,
Absolutely, so to speak, across
the oceans.
And that is the Conservative position on this, that this is opening up the world to Canadian productivity. And, of course, Mulcair is taking the same position that people on the left in the United States are taking, which is that all it's doing is opening up Canadian industry to be undermined by cheap industry elsewhere. I thought it was very interesting that the media I was reading over the weekend gave Trudeau big marks for saying, well, we don't know what's in it, so how can I comment on it until I actually see the details?
That's a theme we've heard here, too.
Right, and that we should analyze the details carefully once we know what's in the agreement. But right now, only the Conservative leadership has seen the agreement that they signed. It hasn't been made public. So Mulcair's opposition, I think Margot's right, has helped with his base and fired up his base, which generally comes more from the left. But I think in the people who are maybe more in the center, well, if we don't know what's in it, how can you be opposed to it?
Echoes of NAFTA, Kirk, right?
Right. Well, in NAFTA, but NAFTA's been, I think, in the standpoint of most Canadians, a success. I mean, there's no campaign right now. The Liberals and NDP aren't trying to get out of NAFTA. There's no talk about that. If you look at the Canadian economy, it has generally grown. It survived the 2008 meltdown remarkably well. It was one of the few industrial countries that didn't see serious problems. Now there are new problems arising since then. So I think NAFTA, has an interesting history because it is really about trading with the United States. Trade with Canada, with Mexico was not really important to NAFTA, but it was making sure that the boundaries were open for Canadian goods to get into the United States.
All right. Coming up, a couple more issues, including the Keystone Pipeline and how Canada's resource-heavy economy will recover from the slump in world energy prices. We'll also hear from you. Join us at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're learning more about today's elections in Canada and what the results might mean for the relationship between the U.S. and Canada. Give us a call with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Our guest for the hour, Zach Azem. He's a research associate at the UNH Survey Center. His master's thesis was on Canada's 2011 federal election. Kirk Dorsey's also here, professor of history at UNH. He teaches courses on U.S. foreign policy and environmental history. And joining us from Ottawa, Margot McDermid. She's national reporter in the Parliamentary Bureau for Canada's national public broadcaster, the CBC. One more time, the exchange number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. So, Margot, to you, one of the issues that I've heard a lot about is how Canada's resource-heavy economy is going to recover from this slump in world energy prices, a slump that is good for energy consumers, but is hurting Canada. Give us a little more there, please.
Well, a large part of our economy relies on the extraction of oil, is particularly from Alberta's oil sands, and that sort of translates into jobs in manufacturing in Ontario, which makes materials for the oil sands now, and so it has had quite a bad effect on the economy. And in fact, during the election, it's been a very eventful election. I said, in the middle of the election, it became clear that Canada has had gone into a recession under a conservative government that talks all about, you know, managing the economy. So that essentially an oil-induced recession, because the rest of the economy is doing fairly well. But because we rely on the oil sands so heavily and the oil industry, our economy went into recession because of that. And so the plan in Canada under the Conservatives is to diversify where we sell our oil to, and to sell more to Asia, which is why one of the big pipelines, the Northern Gateway Pipeline, was approved by this government, and then also try and get our oil out to Europe, which is another pipeline that's being proposed and has also entered the campaign. So the Conservatives are still very focused on using the resources, particularly petroleum, to boost the economy. The other two parties are saying we need to diversify much more quickly than the Conservatives are talking about.
So sell oil elsewhere, but if the price is, you know, low globally, what are people saying about that?
Well, they're betting that it's going to go. They're betting it's going to go up, to be honest. And also, the industry itself is sort of downsizing slightly in Canada and diversifying into clean energy. So that's one of the options that is now happening in Canada. But the discussion has really sparked this discussion in Canada that we cannot put all our eggs in this resource basket, that our economy has to change. So no longer is the petroleum industry seen as sort of the driver of our economy. And right now there's this big discussion of what do we do now?
Well, and this gets into an issue in our elections here, right, Kirk? The Keystone XL pipeline bringing that tar sands oil from Canada down to the U.S. and so forth.
Yeah, so there's been a big environmentalist movement, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, against Keystone in the United States. And it's been a big issue already in the Democratic side, but it's generally supported by Republicans. So like the TPP, it's splitting the Democrats because the Obama administration appears to be in favor of Keystone, even though it's sort of moving slowly on the issue. And I think it's also a really interesting issue. So the problem with Keystone is that it seems like it's particularly intensive in terms of climate change, that the energy required to get that oil out of the tar sands and to get it down to the open market, it seems like it's a particularly damaging way from the people who are really concerned about climate change to do that, in addition to the fact that where the pipeline is running, for instance, through is it going to run through the aquifer in Nebraska and potentially destroy the aquifer that's responsible for all the food grown in Nebraska, Kansas, and North Texas. So there are two issues there at stake in the United States. But likewise, the issue in Canada is, are we going to be an oil-producing nation when the parties who are not the conservative parties basically accept global climate change and that there needs to be international control? The conservative party has pulled out of the Kyoto Protocol, which Canada had signed. And so that's a pretty amazing step that the conservatives pulled out of that, basically saying that they didn't think this is a solution to the problem. There are other ways of dealing with climate change to the extent that it's a serious problem. So it's a particular issue about how we're going to manage our economy, but it's a larger issue about the role of petroleum in the global market? Should we, in fact, be emphasizing petroleum or other ways of getting energy to drive our economy?
Well, here's a little bit of Mulcair, Thomas Mulcair. He's the leader of the NDP, the New Democratic Party. And as we've been saying, that's the more left party. Here's Mulcair giving his argument for why the Keystone XL pipeline is a bad idea.
40,000 Canadian jobs would be exported to the United States with Keystone XL. That's not our figure. That's the Government of Canada's figure under Mr. Harper's Conservatives. I want to create those 40,000 jobs in Canada. Let's add value to our natural resources here. That's the way to sustainably develop our resources.
Again, that's a debate. That was NDP party leader Thomas Mulcair on the Keystone XL pipeline. So just to clarify, Margot, so Stephen Harper supports Keystone XL. Sounds like Mr. Mulcair does not. What about Justin Trudeau?
Justin Trudeau supports the Keystone Pipeline. Let's face it, the Keystone Pipeline in the Canadian side is already built. It was approved and built long ago. We're just waiting to sort of cross the border, which needs presidential approval. The Liberals are saying, yeah, okay, fine with the Keystone. We support that. They don't want the Northern Gateway, which is a pipeline that would bring oil from Alberta to the BC coast and use tankers to bring this heavy oil down. Everyone's worried about spills. So depending on the pipeline, you get various different stances from the various parties. But just to go back to the whole concept of the Keystone Pipeline, the Conservative government has been lobbying the U.S. government for years on this. Every time anyone from Canada goes down to Washington, somebody raises the issue of the Keystone Pipeline. Really ad nauseum, I think, if you talk to people in Washington about it. And at one point, Stephen Harper said it was a no-brainer. There was a real assumption by the Conservatives that it would simply be approved. And it has quickly become, as you know, a huge issue in the U.S., much to the surprise and really the consternation of the conservative government. They did not expect that.
Well, here's a Facebook comment that just came in from Patrick. He says, I would note, as a Canadian currently studying in New Hampshire, that one issue that may go unnoticed, perhaps because the Canadian press has brought little attention to it, is Prime Minister Harper's record on democracy. Patrick says Harper has had little regard for Canadian elective and non-elective institutions, transparency and accountability, the spirit of the Constitution, even laws his own government has passed. Patrick says in his efforts to build a parliamentary majority and remain in power, he has pulled tricks that even John Mitchell, Lee Atwater and Karl Rove could never have dreamt up. Patrick says, all things considered, it is astounding that Harper's record here has not been meaningfully scrutinized during the campaign. Margot, have you meaningfully scrutinized this?
Well, I personally stood outside the Governor General's office for 10 hours scrutinizing what was going on inside. He's referring to, well, I'll give you one example. He had a minority government when he was first elected. And if you don't have the majority, you need support of the other parties to pass legislation and to give you confidence, you know, support a confidence motion in your government. He was about to lose that. So Stephen Harper went to the then Governor General, Michel Jean, and said, I want you to prorogue or essentially put Parliament on recess until I can sort of get my act together here. And she doesn't have to do it. She's the Queen's representative in Canada, and it's her decision. She didn't have to do it. And he thought it was going to be a sort of a short conversation. It took hours. And so she eventually said yes. But that was seen as a very anti-democratic move by Harper. And that's one example.
Well, and you just mentioned something else that I'm guessing, Zach, a lot of people don't know. The Queen has a representative in Canada.
Right. So there's the Governor General, which is actually also in other countries within sort of the Commonwealth. So Australia, for example. And they do, they're, you know, not well publicized, but they do have a very important power. And like Margot was saying, proroguing Parliament at that point. So, so basically when a party goes to call the election, they go to the Governor General and get a writ to make that happen. So it's an interesting aspect to the whole system.
And I'm guessing an aspect that a lot of people don't know about. And Patrick, thank you for the Facebook comment. You know, his comment brings up another point. We here in the United States, Kirk, tend to think of Canadians as so nice. Certainly whenever I visit there, everyone is absolutely lovely to me. But there has been some nastiness in this campaign, Kirk. You know, accusations of graft and corruption and people behaving badly. And then we've got this Facebook comment from Patrick. Without getting into the sort of he said, she said, Kirk, what do you make of this? Is sort of some people say American political nastiness is spreading north.
Well, in some ways, this is the little brother thing again. The Americans look at Canadians and say, oh, they're so nice, as if they're somehow markedly different from other people around the world. And yes, most Canadians are nice and most Americans are nice, too. But if you're fighting over something really important, you get agitated. And there was one of the things I found over the weekend on YouTube was this wonderful exchange between Harper and Mulcair, where they're each accusing the other, you know, listing all the things the other had done as leader of the party, and you know,
yes.
All the things they had done in Parliament that were illegal, and challenging each other on these things, and of course not answering each other's questions about these. So you know, there's anytime you get a democratic system where there are people who are fighting for things that they think are important, they start bending the rules. And I don't think there's anything. I mean, Jean Chrétien had problems as well where people were concerned near the end of his term as prime minister. I think Harper has probably pushed further than anybody. Patrick, I agree with you on this particular point. But I also think that there's nothing particularly surprising. I mean, let's look at that Blue Jays and Texas Rangers game the other day where there was a call that was controversial and there were Toronto fans throwing stuff onto the field. And there was a sense of, oh, my goodness, these are Canadians. Well, they're just baseball fans. They're not that different from the people in Fenway or the people in Texas or the people in California. And we've seen this all over. And it happens all over the world, right? Sports gets people riled up and they throw things on the field when they shouldn't. So I think this is one of the sort of fictions that Americans have about Canadians is somehow they are much different than us in that way.
What do you think, Margot? Has American political nastiness spread north, or have you always had it and we just didn't notice?
I don't know if you call it American political nastiness, but political nastiness has definitely spread in Canada. It sort of started, people blame Harper, but I think it started before that with Jean Chrétien, the Liberal prime minister, who went through a sponsorship scandal, which really decimated the party. And there was a lot of nastiness over that. But Stephen Harper has a different style. His style is, I just need to get enough people to give me a majority, and the other people essentially are less important. So he has a very sort of us and them approach, has always had that approach. It's won him elections, so people support him on that in some cases. But it's also, it may appear that it's going to lose him this election this time around. So he has consistently thrown people, as they say, under the bus if they either go against him or if they're his opponents. And he's always had that style. He's particularly accused of that with we call it a Senate scandal. And without getting into the weeds, there was a Senate scandal around an appointment of a senator in Ottawa who essentially took some money from the prime minister's chief of staff, a $90,000 check. And when that happened, Stephen Harper essentially threw everybody under the bus on that. And so, yes, we have a political nastiness that is relatively new, and frankly, people don't like it. There's a lot of concern about it in Canada, which is some reasons why we have the anybody but conservative movement in Canada. They just are tired of it.
Well, and certainly American politics, Zach, has its share of scandal and political shenanigans. Is it a little easier to do this, though, in a parliamentary system where you have a couple parties at play and you can sort of call elections whenever you want and so forth?
Well, and I think that there's also, in a parliamentary system, there's question period almost every day. And so that's an opportunity for...
Now, what is that?
So basically, it's all parliament meets and the opposing parties get to ask questions to the prime minister, who then also, you know, he might answer some, he delegates others. But so it's basically a debate every single day.
Wow.
And yeah, it's pretty interesting. I tend to watch it. I know I'm probably the only person who does in the U.S. But
Kirk probably watches it too.
yeah, so it kind of allows the parties to hone their message, to air their grievances, and it's not something you really see in our system.
Is that sort of what we sometimes hear in British media, where someone's talking and everybody in the House of Commons is shouting over him or her and so forth?
Exactly. It's the British might even take it to another level, but Canada essentially has the same thing, yes.
You know, there's one more issue that I have not heard that much about in this election. I'll ask you, Margot. We talked earlier about how the French-English split hasn't come up that much this time around. What about the rights of Indigenous people, Native American Canadians. Has that been an issue in this campaign, Margo?
It has. Another issue that came up, because there's this phenomenon in Canada, it's essentially called murdered and missing Aboriginal women. More than 1,200 Aboriginal women have either been murdered or gone missing and still are not found over the past couple of decades.
Wow.
And it's become a really, really big issue. There was at one point, there was a lot of pressure for the Conservatives to hold a public inquiry, like, why is this happening? And I was actually at the press conference where the Prime Minister said, that's not on our radar, that's a crime. Crime issue, we're dealing with it as a crime issue. Many people think it's a larger societal issue. And what has happened is that we have this whole generation of young, educated, more engaged Aboriginal people in Canada, and they're getting out to vote more than in any other campaign. There's a big push to get young people, young Aboriginal people to vote. And if they get out, that's going to have quite an impact on the election. And the murdered and missing Aboriginal women is a very big issue in that. I think before we go, though, we have to talk about, perhaps in a few minutes, that even if people do vote either for the Conservatives or for the Liberals or the NDP, it may not be over, because there's other steps that have to take place if they get a minority government. But back to your question, the Aboriginal population is engaged in this election in a very interesting and very different way.
Kirk, go ahead
quick. And even with the pipeline issue, sending a pipeline over to British Columbia dealt with questions of Aboriginal rights on the coast and where the pipeline was going to come in, whose land it was going to go through. So it has been, again, resources and Aboriginal rights have been tied together recently.
So, Margo, even though we might get some results late tonight, early in the morning, there'll be a lot that remains in play. Sounds like that's what you're saying.
Oh, yes, because, and we'll not get into the total weeds, but essentially, to get a majority to actually prevail in the House of Commons and win, you have to get 170 seats. If you don't get 170 seats as a party, you get a minority. And in order to prevail as a government, you need support from the other two parties, at least, or at least one other. If you don't get that, your party will fall. So if Stephen Harper, let's say he gets a minority government, less than 170 seats, the other two parties have said there's no way and, well, no snowball's chance in hell, one of them said, that we'll support him. So it would be up to the Governor General to decide, could the other ones,
the Governor
the other
General
parties,
being that Queen representative again?
The Queen's representative,
okay,
could
wow.
turn to the other party and say, okay, he just lost support of you. Could one of you form the government? And then it's most likely it would be the Liberals with the support of the NDP.
All
of this takes time.
And we're going to wrap it up here. We're going to close out with the Canadian National Anthem as played by the Edmonton Symphony Orchestra, O Canada.